Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.
Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Bose Aviation, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Massimo Mighty Sat, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have a spectacular show for you this evening. Commander Willie Driscoll is here. We're going to talk about his amazing aviation story and his truly incredible military service to our country. Before we get started, just a few things. Spring has sprung for those of us in the northern climates here. We're starting to see the snow melt and the airports open up and events happening everywhere. And that means we have tens of thousands of aviation events and destinations, everything within socialflight.com and the free mobile apps for Apple and Android devices. Just do a search for one word, Social Flight, and you'll be able to see all of that and get it on your personal device or just look it up on your browser. And there is so much to do there. I just want to be able to share that with you, including our FAA learning system. We have all sorts of WINGS events with the FAA program. If you are an AMP or want to learn to be one or just want to learn what it is they do, then we also have aviation maintenance technician courses and even courses that are used by AMPs with inspection authorizations to get their renewals. Every 2 years, one of the ways that IAs renew is to get 8 hours of continuing education. We offer that completely free through Social Flight with FAA certified certificates that they get and that allow everyone to renew their IAs and do it all through qualifying in Social Flight. And it's pretty cool for anyone to be able to see those courses and take them for free and understand about so many things that affect you and the aircraft you fly, including the, you know, oils, aircraft maintenance, you name it, it's all in there. And then lastly, we have our Fly to Win challenge. We just gave away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset, and we are giving away another one coming up very, very soon on April 1st. That's right, April Fool's Day, we are giving away a headset, a Lightspeed Delta Zulu, so be sure to check that out as well. And the last thing I'll mention is that we're going to be down at Sun and Fun, and if you want to come around and bump into us, I may even have giveaways there as well. All you need to do is hang out and go visit any of the sponsors that are here on the board behind me, and chances are I'll be spending quite a bit of time with them. So visit them, ask for me, and chances are they can tell you when I'll be back, and we'll get to say hi in person. Tonight's broadcast is brought to you by Continental Aerospace Technologies. We fly behind a Continental engine, recently upgraded our cylinders with Continental cylinders, and I'll tell you, they are absolutely spectacular. I've done extensive flying over water and in situations that really can get you concerned, and I just have so much confidence behind this engine and those cylinders. And also they have a newly expanded factory training program I'm going to be participating in, and also bringing news to you that it really teaches people about their engines, especially maintenance professionals. So be sure to check that out. Now, on to tonight's guest. I am so very excited. Commander Willie Driscoll is one of the most decorated naval flight officers alive, with awards including the Navy Cross, 2 Silver Stars, a Purple Heart, 10 Air Medals, and a nomination for the Medal of Honor. He has flown 170 combat missions, accruing 3,300 hours of jet fighter flight time, 500 aircraft carrier landings, and more than 5,200 jet jog fights as a member of an instructor with Top Gun. And he's also a member of the Navy's first and only team of jet missile aces, with the shoot down of 5 enemy jet fighters in air combat. That is a truly amazing accomplishment. Commander Driscoll is a Navy ace and former Top Gun instructor. As we mentioned, his story includes dogfights flown at speeds approaching 600 miles an hour at altitudes below 300 feet, all while evading multiple surface-to-air missile and anti-aircraft attacks. It was an ultra-intense environment where only the best prepared and trained survived. For the past 28 years, Willie has worked as a professional keynote speaker, providing his peak performance under pressure speech to corporate and military audiences. And he has a book of the same name, which is an incredible book, and I really recommend that you go check it out. We're going to talk about that book as well. And he invites audiences to join him inside the cockpit of his jet fighter on one of his dogfights to the death. But Willie's talks are not just about flying air combat. Rather, they're about how the aces teamed up and handled tension, anxiety, and stress of daily combat. He explains how these essential questions for every effective team leader can be answered. And Commander Driscoll teaches his audience how to perform at their best when the pressure on them is the greatest. Please help me welcome to Social Flight Live, Commander Willie Driscoll. Hello, sir. How are you doing?
Very good, Jeff. Thank you very much.
Thank you so, so much for joining us this evening. I'll tell you, that introduction it barely scratches the surface of so much that you've accomplished, and I can't wait to discuss it with you this evening.
Well, thank you again for having us, and thanks also to your viewers joining us this evening, and we're delighted to be with you, and we're looking forward to the next hour.
Excellent. Well, so take me back to the beginning. Tell me what it is that motivated you to join the Navy, and also the selection process of not just joining the Navy, but becoming a naval aviator.
Well, you know, I grew up in Massachusetts, and just as a quick footnote, my mother was a school teacher in town. I went to Catholic grammar school. My mother knew all the nuns, and my fourth grade teacher, Sister Agnes Teresa, said, "You know, Mrs. Driscoll, we don't think Bill's going to make it to the fifth grade." So thank you again for the kind words. But I grew up in a family. My grandfather worked in an armory during World War I. My father fought during World War II for the Army. He was with Patton. And I just felt when I got out of college, you know, the country was at war in Vietnam, and I thought it was my turn now to step up. I always felt a special privilege to live in this country. It's a special place despite all of its problems. As we say, the goods still far outweigh the others. So I thought it was my turn to step up, and I wanted to get into naval aviation because everybody, when I was in college, everybody said, "You can apply, but it's impossible to get in. Nobody gets in." So I took that as an interesting challenge. You know, bought a book on flying, paid a guy $40 to take a little Cessna flight and understand what a rudder does and what an aileron does. Took the flight aptitude test, and I remember the gentleman that gave me the test said, "Hey, you got an aptitude for flying." I didn't tell him that I just bought my book and studied up on it a week or so before the test, but that's what I did. I got accepted into naval aviation, went down to Pensacola, went through aviation officer candidate school, lived with the Marine drone instructors for 20 weeks before getting our commission. That was for those that have been through it, it was quite an experience. And I think there was something like 86 of us started. About a year and a half or so later, about 18 got their wings. And I think there were like 5 or 6 of us got them in jets. And as a flight student, I worked real hard, but my grades were slightly above average, but I put in a huge amount of time. But the Navy has a great buddy system. And there were others in my class that maybe majored in physics or in aerodynamics, and they could help me understand how an airplane, the power plants of an airplane or electrical system, how that works. And when I joined the Navy, I joined not knowing how to swim. So my roommate, he and his twin brother had been water ski instructors up in the state of Washington State. So they spent a lot of extra time with me. And once I learned how to relax in the water, I couldn't believe how easy it was. Although I was on sub swim for 20 weeks, and then I was a swim hole for 1 week. And the Navy takes this seriously. You have to come up to the standard, or at some point they're going to ask you to leave. So I was highly motivated to want to learn what I needed to learn to move on with the program. And thanks to the help of others, I was able to continue.
That's fascinating. So not only having to tackle the odds of getting in the cockpit and making the cuts, but learning how to swim at the same time in order to do that.
Yes, it was. You know, the crazy part of that, if your listeners, anyone that might be up from the Northeast, there's in the state of Rhode Island, there's a place called Block Island. My father was a lifeguard out at Block Island for 3 years. He was a college football player. So how I missed that, don't ask me why, because we took our summer vacations down to the open ocean at Scarborough State Beach down in Rhode Island. And we were in the water all the time, but I just never picked up on it. But once I learned how to relax in the water, I was amazed at how easy it was to pass all the tests.
So you were natural fish. You just didn't know it at that point.
I wouldn't go that far. I would say I was probably a guy that once I learned how to relax, I couldn't believe how easy it was.
Without jumping ahead too much to get towards your book and everything that you focus on, I am curious about, you know, you're self-motivated enough to put yourself in there and get to OCS and get accepted for flight training, even when the odds were against you. And yet the odds you just described to getting into a jet cockpit were, you know, five in a huge number. What is it that you would say makes the difference for that? Like, what was that deciding factor?
Sure. You know, when I was down at Pensacola, Sunday afternoons, the Blue Angels at the time were flying the F-4 Phantom, and they would come back through to the Naval Air Station. Before they landed, they'd do a loop around the field. And just seeing them come in roaring in tight formation, to me, that was the coolest thing in the whole wide world. And I also was highly motivated by, you know, in a fighter, somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. Now, I'm not I'm not a violent person at all, but to me, that was the ultimate competition, because the loser is going to, his fight is going to end suddenly in a huge fiery explosion. The winner can move on to the next airplane or move on to go back for the next day's mission. So in my view, it was the epitome of the competition. That doesn't get any more severe as a competitor than the winner gets to live, the loser dies. And I don't mean that in any kind of a particularly aggressive way. It's just had strong feelings that was a something that I wanted to see how I would do if in that situation. And I wanted to do my part to help the country and support our prisoners of war at the time who were being horribly treated by the enemy in North Vietnam. So I was highly motivated on those two counts.
That makes a lot of sense, because that was during a time that, of course, there was a lot in the news of what was happening to these pilots in Vietnam.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about the process, because of making it through flight training down there and getting up to the point that you graduate and are able to go out on deployment, because that in itself is, as you mentioned, a real massive process of coming up to speed or being cut even after you make the first cuts.
Well, you know, I absolutely wanted to get those wings of gold. So I spent a huge amount of time in the trainer. There's several of the fellas, I mean, that this whole process was easy to them. And, you know, again, the Naval Aviation Buddy System is terrific. So on my best days, I was probably solid average, but I can't tell you how many countless hours we spent in the trainer practicing the different things that we're going to encounter in the air, so that when I get up into the air, I had a pretty good sense of what was expected of me and what I needed to do to complete the mission properly and correctly.
I've heard from other guests that you basically get three times if there's a problem, if you're not passing something at most, and that the stakes kind of rise each time. So even that is a test of character if you're kind of marked down on a maneuver or something during your training.
Oh, that, you know, the Navy's got a very strict set of protocols, and I can tell you, so does Top Gun. When I get up to Top Gun some years later as an instructor, we have a standard that's up here, and we don't lower the standard. And we will work real hard with the students, but they have to come up to the Top Gun standard. And if they can do it, great, they get to continue. But if they can't, then we will give them reflies and work real hard with them. But if they can't come up to the standard, at some point, we're going to ask them to leave.
Yeah.
And they do get sent home.
Yeah. So tell me, take me to Vietnam. Tell me about your deployment.
I was on the USS Constellation. I flew with Randy Cunningham. We flew. He was a second tour guy. I was a first tour guy, what they call a nugget. So we crewed up together. We liked working with each other, although it was not harmony at the beginning. And we had a little this back and forth until we kind of both figured out how we would best get along and work with each other. But we worked it, and we were very intent upon bringing our best effort every day, particularly in the combat arena. So we spent a lot of time talking, working together, preparing. I would say we had maybe 18 minutes of actual either hot vectors, in other words, you're heading toward an enemy airplane, or the dogfight itself, 18 minutes. And of that 18 minutes, we probably spent somewhere in excess of 700 hours per minute getting prepared for that. So we spent a lot of time getting ready for the actual fights.
What aircraft were you flying at when you first went to Vietnam?
The F-4 Phantom, the J version, F-4 Phantom J.
That's a massive, massive aircraft. That's one of my favorite. It's just when you're next to that, it's amazing that it's two human beings in it.
Well, it smokes until you go into afterburner. The black smoke comes out, but it's one of those airplanes. It doesn't do anything exceptionally well, but it does a lot of things pretty doggone well. And it got us through some extremely difficult times in some of our combat dogfights. So yeah, I have nothing but the greatest respect, affection, and admiration for that airplane and those who designed it.
You mentioned, of course, about the amount of training that went in preparation before you would get into combat. But take us inside combat. Tell me a little bit about like your first combat experience.
You know, I don't think anything can prepare for that, because the veterans will tell you what it's like and all this. But I remember the first time I saw the surface-to-air missile. You know, we're up here and there's this missile coming right at us, and as we broke hard down, it came up, nosed over, and it's coming down. And then there's two others coming the other direction, and then one of the airplanes in our flight gets hit. People are screaming. It's wild. There's all kinds of displays going on with your electronic equipment. We got bombs on the airplane. We're trying to break to avoid the missiles. So the first time I was actually into a severe combat situation, I couldn't believe the level of intensity, the tension, the anxiety, the stress, and fear. My view has always been that fear left unchecked can turn to panic. And once panic sets in, chances for mission success are severely reduced. So we wanted to make sure we had a system in place to deal with the fear, and the technique we used was over preparation. We just really, we tried to cover all the possibilities well in advance, because when you're up there doing it for real, you don't have time to think. It's reaction flying, and you're scared. You know, you got the shakes going, trying not to throw up. You usually don't, but some guys do. You're trying not to mess your pants. You usually don't do that either, but some guys do. The rule in our squadron was if you did those things, then when you came back, that didn't mean you were a bad person or anything. It just meant you were just reacting to the moment. Because in the moment when there's missiles coming from different directions, there's enemy airplanes inbound to you, or you're in the actual fight and planes are getting hit, planes are blowing up, people are screaming on the radios, it's pretty intense.
Wow. So, I mean, tell me about the different aircraft that you evolved through while you were on deployments.
Well, I was with the F-4 Phantom on VF-96 on board the Constellation. Then I got orders back to Top Gun, and at Top Gun we flew TA-4s, A-4s. I didn't have any time in the A-4, right? The TA-4 was a two-seat airplane. It had a fair amount of time in that, maybe 70, 80 hours. We got T-38s. I got about 250 hours in that. And we got several F-5Es, actually F-5Fs. Those were dual-seat airplanes. So it was a great time at Top Gun because we were putting the syllabus out there for the first time. Our students were going into combat. They were shooting down enemy airplanes. They were back in touch with us about what was working, what wasn't working. We were tweaking and adjusting the syllabus. We were flying twice a day. I got to fly with the finest pilots in the world. I mean, these are folks that, as we say, have no qualms about flying the airplane 1 inch from out of control at all times in a purposeful way. Got to fly with them. They gave me a number of flying lessons on how they do things, how they roll the airplane just so to get the nose where they wanted to, how much rudder they use to get the plane to do what they wanted to. So it was a very uniquely special time.
Wow. So now help us all understand the timeline. So you were in Vietnam in combat in the F-4 Phantom, and fill us in on that time period before we get to the Top Gun side and how you got selected for that.
Sure. We got there in like late fall of 1971. And at that time, our missions, the first 6 to 8 or so weeks, were primarily involved with bombing Ho Chi Minh Trail. And the Vietnam War was an interesting war because it would run hot and cold. I mean, sometimes we were in the thick of it going into the heartland of North Vietnam. Other times we were in the outer fringes over in Laos and Cambodia. It depended on what was going on at the time. The first time I actually went into the heartland of North Vietnam and saw the multiple surface to air missiles, huge black traps, airplanes crisscrossing the sky, people screaming and all this. That was in right at the end of December of 1971. And then we started going in January 72, we started going in regularly on a daily basis into different areas of North Vietnam. And on the 19th of January, Cunningham and I were flying what's called a MGCAP. So our job was to protect the strike group, and they went into a particular target area. In this case, we're going into what was believed to be an enemy airfield with two suspected enemy airplanes, two suspected MiG-21s. As we approached the field, the skies lit up. We had 4 to 6 coming from the surface air missiles from the right, 4 to 6 on the left. We made hard breaks to the right, reversed quickly, hard breaks to the left. When they first come off, they look like a railroad flare. You know, they start out, and I won't say slow, but in the end, they're closing us at 1,000 feet a second, which is about 3 football fields. So as you're breaking hard down, the missile's nosed off and it's coming down after you. So you have to reverse and break hard over the top. You put your nose out of phase what the missile's nose is doing. Where it gets a little difficult is as you're making the hard break to the right, as you roll back, there's the one right on top of you to the left, and then it's a real quick reaction back to the left to avoid that missile. So we started that evasive maneuvering somewhere around Mach 1.1, maybe 630 miles an hour to 25,000 feet. We ended up at 250 miles an hour at 7,500 feet, which in a jet in a mission like that, that's really slow. We always told ourselves we didn't want to get below 400 knots or 400 miles an hour. So Randy took the nose and he went into what's called a graveyard spiral, just to corkscrew through, because we knew we were right now in the heart of AAA country. As we came through the bottom of this, he picked up two MiG-21s that are in tight, we call it welded wing formation, heading north. So we dropped in behind them. We actually get down somewhere, gosh, I'm going to say we were down something below 100 feet. And we were maybe at this point, because we had been in a steep dive, we accelerated. The MiGs were going fast. And we ended up going probably 550 miles an hour, somewhere less than 100 feet. And They were right tight together. He fired a missile. One of the MiGs made a hard break, broke away. The other one kept on running. And the MiG that broke away reversed back and tried to get back in position. And when he did, we just put our nose on his tailpipe, fired a second missile. The sidewinder came off and went right up his exhaust pipe. They both were an afterburner. It was like a bluish glow. And he exploded. And then Randy rolled the airplane and said, Willie, look at that. And he rolled the thing about 135 degrees. And I realized we're maybe somewhere 100 or so feet, karst ridge around. It seemed we were so low, it seemed like the wing of the airplane could scrape the ground if you rolled at 90 degrees. And we were right on the deck. And I saw this MiG-21 hitting the ground, tumbling end over end. At this point here, we did not want to give chase to the other MiG because we didn't know if he was trying to suck us into a flak trap. We were particularly worried about our fuel state, and we were by ourselves right now in the middle of North Vietnam. So he said, give me a heading out of here. And for a second, I thought, do I want to go back toward the ocean? I said, no, let's stick with what we briefed. So we made a turn back to get, and the main strike group was maybe 10 to 12 miles out in front of us, going back through Laos. So we made a hard break and started to climb. And we got looked at by all the surface there, missile sites again, but they must have already fired because they didn't shoot. We had strobes all on either side of our scope. So we climbed back out, and the tanker, we were tight on gas. We thought didn't have enough fuel to get back to the ship. And the tanker had been reported sour, but we were going to fly into Da Nang and land there and get refuel and go back out to the ship. But we decided to just hit the tanker to see what would happen. And lo and behold, the orange light in the back of the tail came on green. So we got the fuel we needed, went back to the ship. Randy said to me, hey, Willie, tell the air boss we want to do a low pass. So I came up on the radio and I said, Phantom approaching the ship, request low pass. And the air boss, who controls the flight pattern on the carrier airspace around the ship, said, negative. Randy's going, why? He's going, doggone it. You know, he didn't say doggone. It was a little more than that. But he expressed his displeasure with that pronouncement by the air boss. So he said, tell him we just splashed the Blue Bandit. So I said, boss, be advised, Phantom approaching the ship just splashed the Blue Bandit. The boss came back and said, what's a Blue Bandit? When he said that, we decided to clear ourselves. So we dropped down flight deck level, 600 miles an hour. We had plenty of gas now, roared by the ship, pulled up, did a couple of victory rolls, came back around, had a hard time slowing down enough to be able to land the plane, came back, landed, and then with our commanding officer, went up to visit the captain of the ship to explain what happened. He primarily was interested in the MiG kill. He was a good old boy from Louisiana. And I'll never forget, he said, boys, tell me about that MiG y'all got. He had been an F-4 pilot himself a few years back. We explained it to him, and I thought, the term is getting put in hack, where they put you into a you're confined to your room. He didn't do this, but he did say on the way as we left, he said, "Now boys, remember, you got to pay attention. You got to obey what they tell you to do. In my pattern here, I can't have you boys coming in like that anymore." Yes, sir. So we left. Our skipper rolled his eyes and got us back into the ready room and said, "So are we clear that this isn't going to happen again?" Yes, sir. So that was the first MiG kill.
Wow. That is an amazing story for your first MiG kill. And I didn't realize that some of these, that you would be engaging at such a low level. That's got to be a really tough situation to be engaging in.
You know, what Randy used to do, we used to fly around just above the clouds and practice some brake turns to simulate like we were low to the ground. And the thinking was we wanted to have ourselves prepared for wherever the bandits were, we were going to be there. And we were going to be there and not just be there. We were going to be there comfortable operating. And we weren't there to look at them. We were there to shoot them down.
Yeah, that makes sense. And where generally were the, and this was MiG-21s you said?
Yes, sir, MiG-21s.
And was that a, I mean, was most of the time, were you dealing with anti-aircraft fire and also, of course, surface-to-air missiles? Or how often did you actually come across enemy aircraft when you were fighting in Vietnam and North Vietnam?
You know, it's a funny situation because you never knew when you went into North Vietnam, you never knew what was going to happen. It was very unpredictable. And we you know, the U.S. had not shot down a MiG in 27 months. So at the time, it was a big deal. But then we went back into, you know, a more of a, I won't say neutral way of operating, but it wasn't the intensity in going into the heartland areas that we had done on this particular mission I just described. But those that maybe served during the Vietnam War, right around Easter time, I was on the Connie and we were in Japan going back to the States. And the North Vietnam invaded South Vietnam and they were overrunning the our allies in South Vietnam in an area called An Lac, which was just a little bit below the demilitarized zone. So, matter of fact, Randy Cunning was already back in the States. He was going up to Point Magu to do some of the test and evaluation work up there. So he got called back to the Constellation. And now we're going right into the heartland of North Vietnam. And I mean, right into the heartland. And each day we went in, we just didn't know what was going to happen, but we might get a hot vector, then it might be told to knock it off. Our second MiG kill, we actually got a hot vector. We're right into the North Vietnam. We're in an area of a river called the Hourglass, where the controller comes up, says the bandits are 20 miles away, knock it off. We're doing what's called an in-place turn. We're making our turn. I happen to be looking over my left shoulder. Two MiG-17s pop through the clouds. One comes toward us, and the other one goes right toward our wingman. I call him out, and Randy sees him. And then he says to our wingman, we have bandits approach, coming up the left side. Take them left. Take them west if you can. I mean, just keep going straight if you can without, you know, if you don't feel too badly threatened. He did this. We pulled in hard behind the bandit that was attacking our wingman. We told our wingman to make a break. We fired a heat-seeking missile, and it hit the MiG, and bam, he blew up. And what happened, though, when Randy was doing this, we now had two bandits on the left side, and another one I saw cross to our 6 o'clock, about 90 degrees off. Where he went on the right side, I don't know, but I assumed he was back, coming back around and putting his nose on us. Now, those bandits carried two heat-seeker missiles under the belly. They had guns in the nose and guns on the wings. So the bandits are right behind us now, inside of maybe 600 feet. We're breaking. We can't shake them. And they're matching the turn. So as we break, so then we try to roll it back. They're trying to roll. It almost looked like their airplane was stuck in cement because it's trying to match the roll, but it's going real slow. And as it did this, we try to build a little bit of nose to tail, get a little bit away, but we couldn't get away from them. As we started to break back in, we saw the belly again. They get ready to shoot us. So we couldn't get away. So at this point, now realize there's a heavy undercast. There's carcerage popping through the undercast. So Randy says, we're going down, Willie. So it was a real abruptly forward on the stick. We went back through the clouds. There were two bandits chasing us through the clouds on the left side. I don't know where the one on the right side was, but we went down right to, you know, 300 or so feet. We're going, there's a place called the Red River. So we're down by the Red River, belly checking back and forth. We know they're behind us, and we just figured if we couldn't see them, all that meant was we couldn't see them. They were back behind us, but we didn't see them again. So our wingman's calling for our position. We're doing this for maybe 8 to 10 miles back and forth because we didn't see him, but we knew they were back there. So then he pulled up abruptly up into the vertical. And when we did, we went back up through the clouds. As we broke through the clouds, I looked over to my right side. There was our wingman. So I just said, check your left 9 level. He looked over and said, oh, tally ho. So I can't say that we planned that. It's just something that was just blind luck that we happened to get back in a position like that. But that was kill number two.
Wow. And then you just basically pulled them right through the cloud deck and they were able to take a shot.
Right.
And wow. What about your other, the last two kills that you had?
Well, that was kill number two. And then 2 days later, kills three, four, and five. We were flying a big strike. There were six Navy fighters, maybe 22 to 24, you know, A6s, A7s, and an A3 jammer. And we were going to the Haidong Railroad Yards, a little bit southwest of Hanoi, the enemy's capital. And going in, I was amazed. I said, God, it's really quiet. You know, are we sneaking up on them? I said, I don't think so, but it was really quiet. And we got to the target area, all hell broke loose. And initially what happened was anti-aircraft. And they, anti-aircraft looks like, it looks like a softball. If this is the airplane, coming slow, 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 goes by fast. And what you want to do when you see that is to get out of that piece of sky as quickly as you can. As we saw this, the airplane that had rolled in front of us, rolled in just before us, all of a sudden exploded. And then I wasn't looking at the plane, right? I'm out of my peripheral vision. I might have seen a chute, but I don't remember. And then we decided at this point, let's get out. We were carrying what's called rock eye, which were little miniature hand grenade type things. They're designed to silence enemy guns. So we rolled in very steep, much steeper than we should have been, and much faster, but it was very uncertain what was going on. We dropped our bombs. We pulled off the target. We're jinking back and forth. I remember looking over my left shoulder, and I saw two black specks right on the horizon. Thought they were Air Force airplanes. And I started looking back across the ground again, see where the bombs had gone off. And there was all these flashes. Looked back again, and the black specks were actually two bandits coming up our left side. So I called to Randy. I said, I called him Wild Man. So whenever I talked to Ocean, it was me talking to him. I said, wow, man, we got two bandits coming up left side. Break left. He said, no joy. Keep talking, meaning I don't see him. What do I do now? I said, break left. They're approaching guns. So all of a sudden, I heard, got him. Made a real hard break. The bandits flew right out in front, reversed back hard to the right, picked out one of the nearest tailpipe, fired a heat-seeker missile, came off our airplane, hit the bandit. He exploded. Mid-kill that fast. From there, we pulled up into the vertical. And the sky on the left side looked like the Battle of Britain. Now, one of the F4s got shot down. The other F4 had been hit, so he had an engine fire. So we shut down the engine. So now there's four Navy airplanes against 30 enemy airplanes. So it's a big fight ensued. So as we pull up in the vertical, we see a friend and an enemy. Look, something. See if I can get it on the camera here correctly. A friend and an enemy, and the friend is here. The enemy's back behind him. Looks like he's coming to join up on his wing, like to come back into the break. So the call is F4 in a right turn, break right. They're continuing. They're a 3G turn. They think it's for somebody else, not for them. Second call is F4 in a right turn, break right. They're still continuing this 3G turn. They see the two bandits back at a half mile. They don't see the third one coming up to join on their wing. He's just trying to come up to get a sweet shot. So the third call, we are obliquely had come down. So now we're back behind. We're approaching a friend and an enemy in our gun sight. So the third call by us is, God damn it, F4, break right. You're going to die. In which case, every F4 out there broke right. And that was okay because they figured somebody must know something they don't know. So they made a hard break to the right. The bandit badly overshot. We came in from his belly side, got him as close to his deep six as we could. Fired a heat seeker. This exploded just after his tailpipe. But when it did, it knocked the enemy airplane decelerated rapidly. We almost hit the plane and the pilot when the pilot ejected. We had to cut away. I can't say I made eye contact, but I actually looked over and I you know, you always know there's an enemy pilot flying the plane, but I looked over and said, yep, there he is. I mean, I didn't say I took about a nanosecond. I said, well, there's the pilot. Took a hard break away to avoid hitting him and all the debris, because when the missile hit his airplane, it decelerated rapidly and pieces started coming off toward our flight path. So as we pulled away from that, we steadied back up. There was a black speck on the nose. And during this time, there's missiles, we have guys in parachutes, people screaming, it's wild and crazy. And we saw a black speck on the nose. And then it turned out to be a MiG-17. We broke hard into him. He broke hard into us. We passed very close aboard. When we did, he turned on the gun. So that's right, he's got a gun. We made a hard break away. He flashed by. We pulled up into the vertical thinking he'd run out at deep 6 o'clock. but he hadn't. He'd gone up in the vertical too, and he was well above us. Generally in a dogfight, you always try to be the higher of the two airplanes. And the diameter here was tight. It was like inside of a mile. Normally you like to have 2 miles plus. So it was tighter than we wanted, and he was well above us. So when he realized he had this huge advantage, he pulled hard down onto us. So through the bottom of this thing, this is us, this is the enemy right behind us, rapidly closing. I actually have my model airplanes here. I can demonstrate a little bit better than my hands. So,
oh, I love that.
The gray airplane, this is us, and the blue airplane, that's the enemy. So he's behind us, maybe now inside of 600 feet. What we're trying to do is yaw the airplane as violently as we can to get the bullets off of us. And the enemy pilot was smart because he only gave a few squirts where other enemy, when they had us in their gun sight, had kept their finger on the trigger the whole time. This enemy didn't do that. As we started up, we end up with what's called a slow speed rolling scissor. And think of it as a race to the wall, and the second airplane to get there is going to win the race. So there's a lot of yaw. We're rolling as we go through this. He's right behind us. As we came to the bottom of this, he's right behind, so close, his nose looked like a trash can. It looked like I could reach out and touch it. And through the bottom of this, we didn't want to hit the ground, so we started to pull up. He's right behind us. He starts to shoot. So we tried to skid the plane as best we could sideways to get out of the plane of bullets. We did another one of those. The last time we went up, we knew we were going to go to zero airspeed, and he was going to kill us because he was a lot faster than we were. So at this point, Randy decided to put the speed brake out, and he put the throttle back to idle, and the enemy wasn't expecting that. So our motion stopped, so the enemy slid out in front. And when he did, the enemy realized now he made a huge mistake. So when he realized this, he dropped his nose, and he ran, and enabled us to drop our nose, pick up airspeed. And I've often asked the pilots at Top Gun, what I do when I describe this kill, rather than me telling them what happened, I always ask for a volunteer. And I describe the situation, ask them, now, what would you do in this situation? So as we go through it, the question now is, we've been in almost a 2 minute fight. The enemy has just flown out in front of us. He's dropped his nose. He's started to run. And I said, the question is, would you go after him? Or would you bug out? They all say, I would go after him. I said, now, remember, our fuel low level light just came on. And we've got severe look down. They always tell us, you don't want to shoot a heat seeker missile over a jungle background. But we figured this is the best we can do. We don't have enough gas to chase him. So although he's well below us, we were looking well down at him. We fired a heat seeker, came off. It detonated just aft of his tailpipe. And about a moment later, he hit the ground. We realized at that point, we almost hit the ground ourselves. We had to do a hard pull up. We found out later, the pilot flying that airplane was the leading ace from the other side with 13 American kills. Whoever he was, all I know is the guy knew how to fly his airplane well. He knew how to work his weapon system. We had our hands full. But what I do with the Top Gun pilots, when I'm done with this little story, I also tell this story when I'm speaking to civilian groups. I say, so what's the lesson of the story? And it's got nothing to do with flying. The lesson is, no matter what, don't ever let up. Nothing's more certain for defeat for those flying any kind of airplane if you let up even for a moment.
That's amazing. And that concept also of speed break and idle, that's right out of the movies. That's where that must come from.
Well, we weren't thinking the movies at that point. We were just thinking survival. We knew that the position that we were in with him behind us, if he was in he was going to kill us at the top of the stairs if we went to zero airspeed. So this was literally the last ditch maneuver we could think of, because had we not done that, it probably would have killed us.
I'm literally saying it the other way around. The movies are from that maneuver. Like that idea of what you've done is what we see in modern movies.
It could
now.
Be. I never want to, I'm not one of these guys that ever want to take credit for something the movies came up with. Just wanted to tell the story as it occurred. And then those that, make movies can do with it what they wish.
So tell me about coming to Top Gun and your initial work with Top Gun and where that led you to where you are today with your work still at Top Gun.
Well, after we now realized right after that, we left, we were talking back and forth you know, we quit paying attention just for a moment. And all of a sudden, we heard this loud explosion. What the heck was that? It was a surface-to-air missile. Still 30 miles inside enemy airspace. The plane continued to climb. Randy said, give me a heading out of here, Willie. So I gave him the heading, and I thought we were okay. For about the next 2 minutes, the plane continued to climb, and it started flying sideways. I looked back over my left shoulder. There have been so many enemy airplanes. I mean, there were times when we had two to three back behind us shooting at us. So I looked back over my left shoulder. There had been two orbiting right at treetop level. I just wanted to make sure that they weren't coming our way. When I looked over my left shoulder, they were coming our way. They were rapidly climbing toward us, and the turtleback area on our Phantom was on fire. So as I reported this to Randy, he said, yeah, I'm losing. The NF4's got PC1, that's Utility System 1, Utility System 2, Hydraulic System 1, Hydraulic System 2, and then Utility System, three different hydraulic systems to do different things for the airplane. So we're losing one of the main hydraulic systems. And once that happens, the controls are going to freeze up like they're in concrete. So the plane's now starting to fly on its own sideways. We're afraid if we bring the nose up, we could stall it. Or if we let the nose fall through, we get into an unrecoverable dive that we can't get out. Now, we're still 30 miles inside enemy airspace. So what he did was he just rolled the airplane with the rudder, whichever way the nose wanted to go, he put rudder in that way. And we did maybe three of these. Oh, think of them as barrel roll type maneuvers with not a lot of G on the airplane. Not lazy roll, but rolling, trying to get toward the coast. Right at the coast, the plane went into heavy wing rock back and forth, flipped upside down, went into an inverted spin, and it was time to get out. And one of my jobs is to, situation like this, is to eject us. Now, we have a handle like this that sits between my legs. So I'm squished against the top of the canopy. I can't get to the handle. And there's fire in the cockpit. Not bad fire, but, you know, there's flames on the left-hand side. I can't see the gauges. There's a lot of smoke. So what I did was I took my left hand, and I've always been a halfway decent shape, so I did a one-arm handstand. Although they teach us to grab the handle with your hand and to pull towards your chin, the best I can do when I finally get there is the top of my two fingers on my knuckle. And I said, you know, if I try to sweeten this, I may not get back down here again. So I said, I'm going with this. I mean, this all occurred in a nanosecond. So I yanked it, bam, it fired. And the next thing I look up, I see the white and orange parachute. We're coming down in the mouth of the enemy's harbor. And then the enemy sent out PT boats to pick us up. So now we had to, you know, get into our survival radios, broadcast our position, get ourselves ready for water entry. You know, me as a guy that didn't know how to swim, now here I am in a situation like this. But I was very confident that I knew what to do because I'd gone through all the deep water survival training. Got into the water, got into the raft, broadcast our position, and the Navy had sent out helicopters. About 20 minutes later, we were both rescued. So, yeah, that's how that happened.
Oh, my goodness. How do you think the Navy managed to get you before the Vietnam forces got there?
Well, we were very lucky. They had been monitoring the whole thing. They knew we were hit. When we were on fire out of control, several of our squadron mates have been screaming at us, get out of the airplane. Who are you talking to? F4 in a spin. You know, we didn't hear any of that because our radios are burned out. So the Navy and the carriers knew that we were in huge trouble. We were ejecting right at the mouth of the enemy's harbor. And on the way down in my parachute, I came up and broadcast my position. Then I came up beeper. So my beeper was going the whole time. So they knew right where to pinpoint me. And they knew they had to get there quickly because it was going to be a race to see who was going to get to us first, us or the enemy. So there were helicopter ships out there nearby to address issues just like this. So they dispatched the two helicopters. One picked me up, the other picked Randy up, and we were taken back to a helicopter ship for physicals and back to the USS Constellation later that day.
Wow. Were there any air cover protecting you during that?
You know, I don't think so, but, you know, I can't remember. I was just so focused on coming down in the chute, making sure I got my mask to one side, getting the gloves off, getting ready for water entry. I don't recall. I would remember if there were airplanes circling overhead, but I didn't see any of that. Wow. I mean, realize we're right in the heart of the enemy's territory. The Navy probably didn't want to send air cover in there because then they would have been right at the surface of missile envelopes. So, yeah.
Wow. That is incredible. So tell me about going to Top Gun. Tell me, let's.
So we were, you know, then we traveled the country for the next 10 months doing speaking tours and things like that on behalf of the Navy. But then I was served on the staff for the next 4 years and, you know, became an instructor and gave, I think, 6 or 7 different lectures and started the first time that we started doing the Echo Range. I thought it was important to that air crews that we trained experienced in training what it's like getting shot at. So we went up to China Lake to these electronic ranges and set up missions so they could experience that. All the displays, and we'd shoot the smoke flares at them, and then Top Gun airplanes would jump in, and big dogfights would occur. And we wanted to give them a taste of what it's like when you're doing it, you know, with a sophisticated air defense network that you have to deal with. So served there for the next 4 years. Left there, got checked out in the F-14, made a couple cruises on board USS Enterprise. Got out of the Navy like in 1981, was asked by Top Gun if I'd be willing to come back to the staff in 1988 and prepare a talk on air combat, our lessons learned. So I interviewed 26 other aces to find out how they became aces. I've always been intrigued by the fact that less than 2% of those that ever flew real combat against real enemy airplanes accounted for greater than 40% of the enemy planes shot down. Those are the aces. So I interviewed 26 of them. They accounted for 212 kills, and I used that as the basis for that early air combat talk. And as I became a professional speaker, I also used the information I got from the aces for how to be at your best when the pressure on you to be your best is the greatest as a professional speaker.
Tell me that statistic again, because that is one I haven't heard before, about what percentage.
Sure. Less than 2% of those who ever flew real air combat with real enemy airplanes in the sky accounted for greater than 40% of the enemy airplanes shot down. 90% of the other fighter pilots who were in the same piece of sky with the aces at the same time didn't get even one kill. So not saying anything good or bad about anybody, just it's a very intense environment. It's very intense. And I don't think people realize, the element of fear is almost overwhelming. The tension, anxiety, and stress are it's very intense. So you have to be wired a certain way to get through that, to not only deal with it, but to put up those kinds of numbers that the aces put up.
So tell me about that. I think a lot of times people think about what makes the right stuff for those pilots that are successful at that level being stick and rudder skills, but you're describing it in stress management and focus and the ability of handling the situation. I'd love to hear more about that.
You know, so the 26 aces I interviewed, the question is, so how they do it? As we say, they kept the plan simple. You can have all kinds of goals, but if you don't have a plan to how to achieve your goal, it isn't going to happen.
Simple formula. Simple plan, relentless preparation, recognizing repetition produces confidence, attention to detail, when am I most hurt, when am I most vulnerable, debrief, how am I doing, satisfied, the day I stop wanting to get better, it's the day I stop being good, repeat the process. And one of the things I do when I speak to my audience is I say, well, that all sounds good, but the glue that holds it together is self-discipline. And I hold up a mirror. I say, take a look at the face in the mirror. Anybody can be self-disciplined on occasion, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about that gritty day in and day out self-discipline. If you want your performance to improve, improve your self-discipline. The aces were self-disciplined in the extreme. That's one of the main ingredients that brought them the success that they got.
Wow. Tell me about your book, Peak Performance Under Pressure.
Sure. I think I don't consider myself anything special. We were well-trained and lucky to be in the right place at the right time. But I am aware that I have a somewhat unusual resume and a somewhat unusual set of life experiences. So I took a lot of what I had learned at Top Gun. I worked for a large commercial real estate company called CBRE, and I was their, they have like 17,000 salespeople. I was number one 5 different times in San Diego, North County. just doing the same things that we did at Top Gun and the way that the things I learned in naval aviation. I mentioned earlier, I've been a professional speaker for the last 28 years. I speak at large Fortune 500 defense contractor events and financial services events. So I don't give canned speeches. So I always interview five or six audience members about a month prior to find out from them what's most important, what they're good at, what they're not good at. I tailor things accordingly, so I'm very centered on what's most important to them when I do these speeches. Again, typical audience sizes, 300 to 500, and do a lot of audience participation. Rather than me telling them how we pick our teammates for Top Gun, realize we get 45 to 50 candidates, and we pick 3 to 4 spots. I explain to them how the Blue Angels pick their pilots and how we pick our air crew for Top Gun. But before I tell them that, I want them to tell me what a good teammate looks like to them. So we go through that. We have fun with it, but no one's made to feel bad about it. It's just a chance to have a discussion. And I don't mean to say that I have the secret sauce, but what I can say is here's what worked when it mattered most, and life or death hung in the balance. Now, any of your listeners, if they wish to get a copy of the book, please suggest they go to my website. They can purchase the book through PayPal. I'll get a notice. I'll gladly personally sign the book for them and a nice little personal message and send it out to them. So anyone interested, we can certainly help them out that way.
And your website again?
Yes, sir. It's very simply www.willy, spelled W as in whiskey, I-L-L-Y, Driscoll, D as in David, R-I-S-C-O-L-L.com, willydriscoll.com.
WillyDriscoll.com. And again, it's absolutely, your story is fantastic. Your lessons are so impactful. I think so important to anyone to take these lessons under such stressful and unbelievable combat conditions. And also, again, what you mentioned of having researched this with the people who made up that success, that difference of 2% to 40%, representing 40% of actual success in combat, and taking those lessons forward, I think is really important. So again, the book, Peak Performance Under Pressure, Bill Driscoll, willydriscoll.com. I'm really grateful for that, and I encourage people to do that. Well, Willie, we have reached the part of the show where we like to do something we call Social Flight's Fast Five, where we ask you five questions. Are you up for doing that with us?
Yes, sir.
All right, Willie Driscoll, this is your Social Flight Fast Five. Five questions to get to know you a little better, take your amazing story and really let people connect with the amazing individual that you are and the service that you have done to our great nation. And I'd like to start with a really pretty straightforward one. When I went through your flight experience in the aircraft, they are all military aircraft except for that first one that you did before heading to the military. But my understanding is you've got 1,000 hours in the F-4 Phantom, my personal favorite from history, 2,000 in the F-14, 200 in the T-38, 30 in the F-9 Cougar, 70 in the TA-4, 10 in the F-16, and 15 in the F-18. That is a large variety. That's a very wide variety of military aircraft. What's closest to your heart out of those, and can you tell me a little bit about why or what things you liked about those other aircraft?
Well, most aviators would say that the one closest to their heart was the last one they flew in. And that's a fair answer. For me, I'd have to say the F-4 Phantom, because after we were hit, somehow that airplane stayed together enough to allow us to get to a point where we could eject. I mean, we went through some monumentally difficult challenges with that airplane in combat. And I was actually at the Air Force Academy a few years ago. I was one of the speakers there. There was an elderly gentleman who came in to the auditorium. So I waited till he took a seat before I started my presentation. I learned later his name was John McDonald of McDonnell Douglas. So halfway through the speech, when I got to the point about us getting hit by the surface air missile, I looked at the audience and smiled and said, "No, I'm in a lucky position here because the gentleman whose company built that airplane is here. And I said, "Sir, I'd like to please stand up. I'd like to acknowledge you." I said, "This is John McDonnell of McDonnell Douglas." I said, "On behalf of all the Navy and Air Force and Israeli Air Force aviators that flew your airplane, thank you again, because you took the amount of time needed to self-seal those fuel lines and hydraulic lines so that when people like me got hit, as we did, we still had enough control to be able to get ourselves a few more minutes to a place we could eject." I thanked him profusely for that. It was a very unique opportunity. So, yeah, anyway, long answer. Favorite plane for me, F-4 Phantom.
That's a very, very powerful experience to have had him in the audience as you were speaking and be able to recognize that. And I really appreciate the acknowledgement of the role that the aircraft itself played in saving your life. Okay, well, that sort of leads us.
It didn't do anything exceptionally well, but did a lot of things good enough. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that leads us and may overlap with our second question here, which is whether one of these, you've had several moments of your life, whether it be in combat or outside of that, that were quite profound and very challenging. Was there is there a moment, scary or impactful moment of that that you feel you really learned something from that you take with you to this day?
There is. Of the five planes we shot down, four of them were catastrophic explosions close to the ground or just huge fireballs. One airplane, I talked about that kill, the pilot ejected, we almost hit him and we had to take a cutaway. So about 5 years ago, 14 North Vietnamese pilots came to the United States. And part of their trip, they came to San Diego. I was asked to participate in a panel discussion with them. And I flat out said, "I'm not doing that. I have no interest in doing that." So one of my friends, though, stayed with it. He called me a couple more times and this kind of thing. So I finally said, okay. So I went down to the San Diego Aerospace Museum. The actual F-4 Phantom that we shot down, our first two enemy airplanes, and the actual real airplane, is mounted down there. It's not a monument to myself and Randy Cunningham. It says Fly Navy Vietnam. But it's painted the original squadron colors. It's got the five red stars on the side of the plane. It's mounted on a pedestal. So I'm on the panel. I do my discussion. The Vietnamese, and they were men about my age, but they were there with their wives, their kids, and sometimes cases their grandchildren. They were so they're all sitting in the front two tables. And the way they did the panel, I would say, for example, our intention was to isolate the enemy as best we could. Then I would stop, and the translator would speak in Vietnamese. Each time they did that, I noticed the Vietnamese all lean forward and listen like that. I got the same reaction I got up at Top Gun. So when I was done, one of the Vietnamese translators came up to me and said, "Sir, there's somebody who would like to meet you." And I said, "Sure." He said, "He's over there by your airplane on the other side of the pavilion." So I went over, and there was a thin Vietnamese guy who looked like Ho Chi Minh with a long goatee. And through the translator, he said, "I got shot down in the spring of 1972. The plane that shot me down almost hit me. I think it was you that shot me down." So that was my reaction too. I said, "Really?" So I looked at the guy and I shook hands with him. And I said, "Nice to meet you." I said, "Don't know what to say. What did it feel like getting hit by the missile?" And he said, "It felt like getting hit in the back with a big stick." He broke his back on the ejection. And he was, I think he said he had six kills, but we ended up in a somewhat, a very pleasant conversation. I said, "So what are you doing now?" And he said, "Well, I'm a farmer outside of Saigon." I said, "Yeah, I like to grow tomatoes." So I said, "What kind of fertilizer do you use?" So we got to talking a little bit, and he was a pleasant guy. So when I got word, I belong to the American Fighter Races. I got word to the American Fighter Races. I did say to him, though, before we left, I said, can I ask him a question? She said, "Certainly." Now, this translator was a very attractive Vietnamese young woman, maybe 25, with a long silk pink dress down to her ankles. So I said to her, "Ask him, how long have you two been dating?" So she translated. He laughed and said, for a very long time. So we shook hands, we hugged, and you know, to think that I would shake hands and hug a guy that we may have shot down many years ago, it was something I'll take to my grave. But I realized when I had heard their presentation, their typical mission lasted 10 to 12 minutes. When they went out, they all expected to get shot down. Several of the pilots that came over to the United States had been shot down 2 and 3 different times. And when their wives would come out to the base, they're like, they had 60 airplanes. And between the Navy and the Air Force, the Marine Corps, we had 1,200. So when the wives came out on Thursday afternoons for visits to the airfield, it wasn't for conjugal visits. It was just to see if they were still alive. So I was thinking to myself, man, that was a tough road to hoe for those guys. Most of them learned how to fly before they learned how to drive cars. They went to flight training, riding bicycles. So it was a very interesting experience to get to know the backside of what their life was like. So yeah, that's something I'll probably remember for the rest of my life. When he did pass away, I got a word from the American Fighter Race Association. So what I did, I have a tailor who's a Vietnamese. So I went down to my tailor, I got a sympathy card, I wrote it out in English, and the tailor put it into Vietnamese, and it went something like this: Dear Bin family, your dad and I met 2 years ago in San Diego. We also met maybe 50 years ago over the skies of North Vietnam. The meeting 50 years ago was not particularly pleasant. The meeting 2 years ago was delightful. Please know that your family's being remembered in my family's prayers. And I signed it, Bill Driscoll. So yeah, it was a pretty heavy experience for a guy like me.
Wow, that is so powerful. Okay, well, that takes us to our next question, which is quite positive, and that is, and fitting with the story that you just told. And that is, if you had an opportunity to go back and re-experience some moment from all of this is flying in your life, just to be back in there, not to change it, just to re-experience something positive, something that was really quite wonderful, where would you go? Where would you put yourself?
And I'd probably put myself in the middle of a Navy fighter squadron ready room, because the men and women today that you come into contact with are just world class. And I say this with great respect for our civilian friends. I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't think we're anything special, but the people, particularly in a combat ready room, I mean, we are partners, and we are giving each other assurance that I will protect your life. And they say, great, I will protect your life too. That's pretty powerful to be able to say that and then go out there and actually do it, in some cases in the most difficult of conditions. So you don't, I have not encountered, I've traveled many places, I've given many speeches, met many wonderful, interesting people, but the camaraderie that you get in a fighter squadron ready room during times of combat, can't beat it. It's just, I'd put into words, but the sense of humor, there's everybody's fair game, the pimping, the teasing, the kidding, but the quality of the individuals, the willingness to do what has to be done in the heat of battle to make sure our teammates are okay. It's special.
What a blessing to have been in that level of camaraderie. That is really quite wonderful. All right, question number 4. If you could go back and give some advice to your younger self before you joined the Navy, what might you say to that younger Willie Driscoll?
The younger Willie Driscoll, I would say, it's going to be okay. Live it one day at a time. You know, although I did try to bring the best version of myself each day, but I was concerned about making sure that, you know, I'm one of these guys, I did not want to be better than somebody else. I just wanted to be the best version of myself each day. But like all of us, you know, you think, gee, if only I had done this, if I'd done that. I mean, for years I kicked myself in the butt because we never should have gotten shot down by that service jet missile. Had we been paying attention, it's not yakking. I'd been looking at the radar screens, and we had displays, we just weren't looking at them. So we, thing I always ask my audience, my civilian audiences too, I say, I show them a brief video clip a moment after we got hit. And then I asked him, why do you think I showed you that video? I said, was it to have you think I did something brave in combat? He says, no. I said, no. I said, I showed you that video because despite perhaps the finest moment of my life, 5 minutes later, I had the worst moment of my life because we quit paying attention just for a moment. It almost cost us our lives. That's why I showed you that video. Whole point there, though, it's not, I don't say this is unique to flying. This is many things in life, you know, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, serious illness, financial troubles, troubles with marital troubles. People today struggle. There's a lot going on in people's lives. So when I do my speeches, what I try to do is offer some hope, a sense of, you know, you can get through this. You know, it doesn't have to be perfect every day. Just try to bring the best version of yourself. I'm very involved with the Navy SEAL Foundation with some of our SEAL brothers that have really struggled with some of their PTSD challenges. And so we try to, you know, put out a helping hand, listen mainly, just have them tell us what happened and offer no advice. You know, we're not medical people, but listen and encourage them to seek medical advice if they're so inclined. So those kind of things, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, the last question. Question number 5 of Social Flight's Fast 5. If you could choose anyone, alive or no longer with us, past, present, famous or not, anywhere in history, to spend an evening with, who would that be?
You.
Well, I've never heard that one before. You sure you don't want to revise that?
Okay. Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. Probably, I'd like to invite you. Someone I've always been fascinated with is Abraham Lincoln. And I say that because, what is it, the 9 days before he took the oath of office, 7 states seceded from the Union. You know, as challenging as things are today, I mean, our country has been through some wild and uncertain times in the past. One of the things that I've always been impressed with Abraham Lincoln is from the time he was 25 to the time he was 45, he ran for public office 7 different times, lost all 7 elections. Yet he later got elected president of the United States, and he's known as one of our greatest presidents. But I've read a number of books about Abraham Lincoln, and he battled depression. He had all kinds of challenges that he had to deal with. He tried to do the best he could with his wife. He lost a child. You know, he just had all kinds of tough issues he had to deal with, and he got through them as best he could. And they didn't set any records, but he showed up every day, and he kept it moving forward as best he could. And I've met some very interesting people in my life, but I would say at the top of the list, if I had to pick one guy or one person that I could go have dinner with and talk to, it would be Abraham Lincoln.
That's a wonderful answer. I love that. And it makes me want to start doing some more reading beyond what I already know about Abraham Lincoln. It's you make some very, very powerful points.
Read the book Team of Rivals. You know, if you haven't read Team of Rivals, I think Doris Kearns Goodwin, I think, wrote the book. And it's a fascinating account of how all the people that he competed against, he brought them into his cabinet, and they all worked together. It wasn't pretty at times, but they got things done. So, yeah.
What a great lesson, especially for today's age. Team of Rivals, another thing to look up. And speaking of books, again, Peak Performance Under Pressure. Go to willydriscoll.com to see that book. Willie, thank you so much. I am truly, truly grateful you took time to join us on the show tonight and to pass along your story and your guidance and the lessons learned along the way. It is so powerful. And if for anyone out there, if you're at a corporation I recommend that you reach out to Willie, and you can go to willydriscoll.com to get him to come and speak to your company, check out the book for yourself. This is just the tiniest sample of really how powerful and wonderful your lessons are, Willie. So again, thank you for joining us here on Social Flight Live.
You know, and thank you for having us. And my last comment to your listeners, I'd like to wish everybody and their families a long and peaceful life. Here.
Wonderful. Thank you, and have a wonderful evening. And thanks to all of you for everything that you do to support general aviation and the world around you. We'll be back next Tuesday, that's March 25th, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, with Greg Bowles of Joby Aviation, talking all about urban air mobility. They are the leading company in these aircraft that are coming to a municipality near you soon. A lot of stuff is happening in that regard, and I'm telling you, it's going to be a pretty cool show to really see what this vision is. I spent some time with him at NBAA this year, saw the aircraft. It is impressive, and I encourage you to come there for that show. That's next Tuesday, March 25th, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and all the time zones in between. The week after that is Sun and Fun, and I'll be down at Sun and Fun and hope to meet some of you down there. I'll be walking the grounds, but the easiest way to find me is go ask one of the folks that are on this board that'll be displaying in the hangars or outdoors in there, and I am sure that they can track me down. Until next time, again, thank you so much for joining us here on Social Flight Live, and I wish you all blue skies.